Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. And well, my talk today is going to be probably, because I wasn't sure what kind of audience I would have. So, and Sid told me that generally the audience can be interdisciplinary. So I made the talk for an interdisciplinary audience, and maybe the mathematics that you're going to find is just in the form of graphs and formulas. Well, I'll be very happy just to go to the board and explain you what we have done in detail. Though you're going to find that probably the mathematics is not that sophisticated, so it's a computational aspect that is more important in here. And well, what I want to do now is that I want to explain you the problem, because it's a very exciting problem in medicine, the problem I'm going to be talking today. So during evolution, what has occurred is that, well, the cell, well, has been evolving, so you have the prokaryote cell that has a jungle of molecules inside. And you have been creating, as evolution has been progressing, so the cells have been creating suborganelles which are specialized into specific functions. And well, there are two organelles which are extremely important. One of them is the nucleus, because it contains all the genetic information, as you all well know. But there is a second one that we don't pay much attention, that is the endoplasmic reticulum. And the endoplasmic reticulum, what it does is the factory for producing the proteins. So two-thirds of the proteins that the organism, the cell, is going to synthesize, they have to go across the endoplasmic reticulum. So you have a pore in the nucleus. And you know, this is a very exciting problem, because the nucleus is still like a black hole in biology. So you have the pores, and then the mRNA, the messenger, would get into the endoplasmic reticulum. And when it gets there, so there is a specialized machinery, mainly composed of other mRNAs, which they behave like enzymes, and they transform systematically every single messenger molecule into a protein. And well, what has happened? So then the protein would have two objectives. One is that it would go to the cytoplasm, or it can get packed into vesicles, could go to the Golgi and then exported. And well, in my case, because I'm in a diabetes research, so one of the proteins that we're more excited on working on, which is insulin. So the insulin gets, you have the mRNA that generates the proinsulin, then the proinsulin is translated into a protein. Then when it gets into the vesicles, the proinsulin is divided into two proteins, so the C-peptide and the insulin. And once it goes there, so it enters into the Golgi apparatus and is exported into the outside of the cell when the release of the protein is required. And well, there is something which is really exciting, and you know, this is part of the mystery of why mathematics is going to be extremely helpful, is that we have all the genome project well established, and we have this very naive assumption that, well, every single gene, it has to be folded into a protein. And as a matter of fact, so the way the folding process occurs is a bit of a mystery, and we cannot actually figure out how the folding process actually occurs. There is a lot of work on this area. And well, one of the things that I have another one to mock the people who actually think that there is a correlation between the genome and the folding, in which you have a trapezius who is running from one corner and then he would fall and go into the other one. So people believe that there is a correlation between the nucleotide structure of the mRNA and then the amino acid structure into the folding. And as a matter of fact, there isn't. So you require to have a very complex machinery that what it's going to do is it's going to fold the proteins together and put it in the right form that it's going to be functional. And well, this folding machinery is called the proteostasis. And the way it would work is that during the transcription, so you have transcription is when you have the messenger coming from the nucleus into the endoplasmic reticulum. The translation will occur into the endoplasmic reticulum. Then you have a polypeptide, which is a linear polypeptide. And there is a bunch of proteins, which are called chaperones, that what they do is that they approach systematically the polypeptide and start to fold it into the right direction. And the machinery that is required to do that, it would depend from the protein. So some proteins, they require to have 25 to 30 proteins to actually fold it in the right direction. Also, they can require hundreds. And we don't fully understand this proteostasis process. So at the moment, it's just a bit it's a bit of a mystery. But one thing that we now understand very well is that failure in the proteostasis machinery can lead to the formation of non-functional misfolded proteins. And this non-functional misfolded proteins, what they can do is that in the long term, they are going to aggregate and they form toxic large macromolecular complexes that they are going to trigger apoptosis and cell death in the long term. And although the process looks relatively straightforward, and it looks like a rare case, because if you think about the folding landscape, so maybe misfolded proteins are not that stable, but as a matter of fact, they're pretty stable and they can live for a long period of time. So during the folding, in the folding landscape, we find a large number of these molecules. And well, nowadays, what we understand is that there is a large number of diseases which are the result of failure in proteostasis. And as a matter of fact, it's not only diseases itself, but as well, aging seems to be the result of the exhaustion of this proteostasis machinery. As we age, the quality control mechanisms that trigger the appropriate folding of proteins start to fail. And as a consequence, many diseases that can occur in young people who have mutations, they will occur spontaneously in older people. And one of them, of course, is diabetes. So, and we can have diabetes. For example, the type 2 diabetes could be the result of a folding protein problem in which the insulin is not folded properly, is not recognized, even if then the body stops actually to work. You accumulate large concentrations of insulin, which is going to aggregate. And when it aggregates, it would trigger beta cell death, apoptosis. But there are other, many others. So you have Huntington's disease, then you have Alzheimer's, folding mutations or folding problems in p53 can cause cancer. Mutations in crystalline, the protein crystalline that occurs in the cytosol, so that's an exception to the general rule of two-thirds, cause cataracts. Many prion diseases, as a matter of fact, the prion diseases, all of them are folding diseases. There are problems that the prions, what they do is that they are proteins which are not folding properly, and then they accumulate in higher concentrations. The big difference between the prion diseases and the rest of these diseases is that this is a contagious disease. So the protein has a configuration such that any other protein that is close to it, it would aggregate. And it's contagious because you can move that protein, which is misfolded, into another cell, and it would cause the same effect. While others, so they don't have the links to attack other proteins. And well, you have collagen, and this list could go on. It's enormous nowadays, and in medicine, this has become a priority. The priority is understanding how actually these diseases can be controlled, how we can stop the aggregation of proteins. And well, my lab has now specialized on that topic. We find that not many theoreticians are working on this area, and it's a perfect opportunity. Well, one of the things that we wanted to do first is understanding evolution created this mechanism for sensing the misfolded proteins. And the mechanism, what it does, it detects a high concentration of misfolded or unfolded protein, and it would stop immediately the production of protein, and it would drive two processes. One is mainly moving away the misfolded proteins and the unfolded ones, or try to fold them into the right shape. And well, and this mechanism is mainly driven by two types of proteins, so the Hitchcock proteins, which are stress proteins, and then the chaperones. And when you have the aggregation process being triggered, so you are moving from the unfolded protein into lower states of energy, so they are very stable proteins that can stay there forever unless the cell removes them. And the same thing would happen with the folded proteins. So you have the unfolded protein that would go into lower energy states until it's folded. And the quality control mechanism that actually drives the aggregation proteins towards the folding, towards folding or degradation is called the unfolded protein response. It's called the unfolded protein response because at the beginning was generally triggered only by high concentrations of unfolded protein. Nowadays we know that it's triggered by even high concentrations of aggregates and misfolded proteins. And one of the things that is described very well in this paper in Science, that this is a mechanism which is relatively new in evolution. Only higher eukaryotes, they have the sensors for detecting high concentrations of misfolded proteins and unfolded proteins. And because a new mechanism is not very robust, and that's why we suffer from a large number of folding diseases, even during aging. That we should probably, those mechanisms that while we age, this would happen, but well, we're living in the brink of a disaster because the mechanism is new from the evolutionary point of view. And well, one of the first things that we did in my lab is that we tried to understand how the fluxes of the proteins would move along the endoplasmic reticulum. And one of the things that would occur in the endoplasmic reticulum is that here we identify the unfolded protein as those colloid structures. We have the VIP, which is the first chaperone that would bind to the proteins. And once that binding has occurred, then the proteins would go into full defolding. If folding cannot occur, then they would accumulate, and then the misfolded proteins would have an interaction with three enzymes, that they are receptors, they are sensors for the unfolded protein response. And if those sensors are triggered, there are three things which are going to occur. The first one is that you attenuate the translation of proteins, so you wouldn't form any more proteins. And the two other processes which are triggered are the activation of the endoplasmic reticulum associated folding pathway, which is responsible for folding the proteins, and then the endoplasmic reticulum associated degradation pathway, which is responsible for degrading all the proteins which are non-functional or they are in higher concentrations and can be toxic. And well, once the sensors are activated, then we say that we are in the unfolded protein response. Downstream in the process, if the unfolded protein response doesn't work, we have ER stress, so the endoplasmic reticulum gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and there are chemical signals which are triggered. The third response is oxidative stress, in which the cell is preparing itself to commit suicide, and the final one is apoptosis. So there is a change of events that would occur if this fails. And well, now our focus, and in fact the focus of the focus of most of the labs, I should say this first, which are mainly experimental labs, have been an understanding what happens outside of the endoplasmic reticulum. So everyone has a very good idea of how the translation attenuation mechanisms and the activation of the associated folding and the associated degradation pathway actually works. So there is a lot of chemistry behind this, and the reaction kinetics are relatively well understood. Nobody knows what's happening inside of the endoplasmic reticulum, where the sensing mechanism is triggering the response. And that's the focus of this talk today. Today, I want to explain you the hypothesis we have of how the sensing mechanism actually works. We have proposed a mechanism, and we can make some predictions, and we have actually explained some of the phenomenon currently observed. And well, as I told you, so if the unfolded protein response fails, apoptosis would be triggered. And in the case, and I'm going to pull back because I have to justify my existence on diabetes center. So one interesting thing that happens is that we have all the proteins are synthesized in their folding state, but as well you will find very high concentrations of misfolded protein, which are synthesized on the normal conditions. And in the case here, we have the insulin, which is fully synthesized. This is a proinsulin. And then you find here two bands. These are bands that we have extracted from the cells. And we're able to separate the proteins according to their folding state. And we have identified two bands and this is a Peter Salman lab, which is a lab I collaborate with. They have identified two bands of misfolded proinsulin, which are highly toxic for beta cells, along with the wild type proinsulin. And well, this is one of the reasons we're studying this process. We need to figure out what occurs when one of the receptors of the sensors would break down. And there's a high increase in the concentration of the misfolded proteins. And well, as I told you, there are three receptors. It's not relevant information. What I want to illustrate is that the chemistry of what happens after the receptors have been activated is very, very well known. So it's not worth doing here any modeling. The modelers can actually solve part of the mystery of what's happening in the ER lumen. And one of the things that we know that is occurring in the ER lumen when the unfolded protein response is activated is that there is a switch-like behavior in the system. So this is the case of Huntington. So in the Huntington disease, what you are doing is that you're adding poly-Q tails to the protein. And this is very interesting. So when you have less than 37 poly-Q tails, you don't suffer from Huntington. In the moment you add poly-Q tails above 37, so 38, 39, you suffer from Huntington disease. The aggregation would be triggered immediately. And what you can notice here, the big difference between the 25 Q tails and then the 46, the concentration of the protein of the aggregates would increase significantly. And we know that the unfolded protein response has been activated, and there is a switch-like behavior, because when you're in the un stress state, which is 25 Q, VIP, which is a folding chaperone, is in a very low concentration. While when you are stressed, you have here a tale of 103 that we know that causes Huntington disease. VAPs in a very high concentration. The same thing will happen with CHOK. The CHOP that is a marker of the oxidative stress response that occurs downstream. So there's this switch-like behavior. And this is part of the mystery that now we have brought a clue of saying if these sensors are going to work, they need to behave like a chemical switch. Because we observe the response on and off completely from one state. You are in the basal concentration and suddenly you are well above the basal concentration. So if we are going to develop a mechanism, this mechanism needs to have a sort of destable behavior or multistability. And then once we have done that, so we figure out that, well, this is what is known experimentally. Now we start to dig a little more of the literature and we try to find out all the tentative evidence that can exist for the different mechanisms. And we have identified, as a matter of fact, three mechanisms that people have suggested. All of them based on empirical evidence, so there is no direct evidence. One of them assumes that, the sensors, what they do is that when they find a high concentration of the unfolded or misfolded protein, they are going to be associated with the unfolded protein or the misfolded protein in the stress state, and when they're on stress, they wouldn't have any folded protein associated. So this is called the direct recognition mold, and it has been proposed by one experimental group. There are two main experimental groups in the U.S. who deal with this problem. The second mechanism is the direct recognition mold, where VAP, as a matter of fact, is bound to the sensor, and when the concentration of the misfolded or the unfolded protein is in a very high levels, then it's going to compete for the VAP. The VAP has a higher affinity for the unfolded protein because it's a folding chaperon. And as a consequence, it would move away from the sensor and it would bound to the VAP. And once the sensor is free, then the response would be activated. And you know, despite that there is experimental evidence, look how these two mechanisms are completely opposite. Here, the free sensor is assumed to be in the stressed state. Well, here the free one is assumed to be the stressed one. So biologists, they don't have a clear clue of what's happening because they have the two extremes. So there is a final mechanism, as a matter of fact, that has been proposed, and people actually believe that this is the most possible mechanism because chemically it could explain that a very limited number of unfolded proteins can actually trigger after they have exceeded a certain threshold. The activation of the sensors. And the mechanism is very similar to the indirect, it's a combination of the two of them, it's very similar to the indirect recognition mold, it's called the hybrid recognition mold, where the sensor phase is bound to the VIP, and once the unfolded protein or the misfolded protein increase into very high concentrations, it would be sequestering the VIP again, because it has a higher affinity, but the unfolded protein, because it's in a high concentration, it would bound as well to the sensor, and this actually would trigger the stress. So in this case, again, the stress response is given by the sensor associated to the unfolded protein, and not like in this case in here. And well, now that we have these mechanisms, of course, we can start to write down the set of differential equations that we describe. Essentially, the thing that we have to do is apply the Rohmer's action, write down then the detailed chemical mechanism. And once we have done that, then we have a series of differential equations. The issue is that this exercise looks very trivial when explained it here. In the moment, then I decide to write it down, it gets slightly more complicated. And explain you why. So let me just show you here of what's happening. So if I decide, for example, to take the Hibbert recognition mold, and this is one version of the Hibbert recognition mold that we have proposed, there are multiple ways of achieving what the biologists are proposing as a Hibbert recognition mold. For example, if I'm going to have, in this case, which is what I'm trying to describe here, we have the unfolded protein and the VAP. So I could say, for example, that what's going to happen is that this is the overall reaction. In the long term, the VAP would dissociate and associate with the unfolded protein, and then the unfolded protein would be associated to the receptor. And there are different steps that I can achieve this. So one is that I can have a triple binding site, where the VAP has an affinity site for the unfolded protein and a site as well for binding to the receptor. That's one possibility, and once the binding of the unfolded protein has occurred, the configuration of the protein would change, of the VAP, it would dissociate, and then I have the free receptor, so the sensor. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that, as a matter of fact, so the VIP could be associating and dissociating continuously to the receptor, and then it could be binding. So that would be a different mechanism that would require a different set of differential equations, and the conservation laws would be different. So what we did systematically is that we started to write down all the tentative chemical mechanisms that could exist to explain this overall reaction in here, this overall reaction in here, and that overall reaction in here. So the overall reaction for each one of the mechanisms, the error recognition, the indirect recognition, and the hybrid recognition model. This is a massive computational exercise because you need to do all the right permutations that would allow you to come with sensitive reaction mechanisms. And well, the rules are very simple, so because chemistry is like sex in evolution, by the way, so you can have sex with yourself, you can have sex with somebody else, but then having three male, female, and something else being together is fundamentally impossible, because by probability, you cannot link three individuals together to create a new one. So it's probabilistically better just to have two. Well, and you can show it with the tables. You can do the probability calculations. The same thing happens in chemistry. So you can have two chemical components mixing with itself and then reacting. And if a third one is going to come in, it has to come with a you know, molecular reaction. So you need to have two combined then with a third one coming in. So that's something that it could actually occur in chemistry. So we computationally start to build the models so that we can describe all the tentative reaction mechanisms. The second problem that we needed to explore was the fact of finding in all these mechanisms at least instability, multi-stability. And this is a massive exercise. If you think about it, so finding a bistable behavior is not trivial, because we're talking about a reaction mechanism that can have 15 to 17 differential equations. In some of them, we have 23 differential equations. So this would take a lot of computational exercise. So we needed to come with a trick that would allow us immediately, by just looking at the topology of the reaction, which ones would be able to trigger the multistability. And thanks God that, you know, my good friend, so George Krasion, so he's a really bright mathematician. If you want to invite somebody who does reaction kinetics, so he's one of the youngest and the finest now. So he published a PNAS paper where he described a way in which, if you write the elementary reaction mechanisms into a network type approach by counting the number of cycles and the type of cycles you will have, he would tell you if potentially that network can give stability. It cannot guarantee you that it will have a multi-stability behavior of stability. We'll tell you that at least there is a probability, a high probability, that that's going to be the case. And as a matter of fact, when we run this, we have 35 different mechanisms that we were able to write in here that were physically realistic between the three of them, and only three of them were able to give stability. So we immediately, the search space got reduced to the bare minimum. And, you know, thanks to George, so I'm really grateful for him that he published this paper. And he was able to give us a hand as well on how to use this very quickly. And, well, one thing that we did is that we wrote, by following the rules that George developed, our hybrid recognition models, so we discovered that this was the three models that were able to trigger stability. The three of them were hybrid recognition models. And then we needed to figure out which one of them is the one that can explain the current experimental evidence and then give some predictions that we can test in the lab. And these were the more interesting mathematical exercises would occur. So what we did is that essentially we have, and this is a very important requirement. So the reaction is not a closed reaction. The reaction that is occurring, as a matter of fact, we have a continuous input of unfolded protein, which is occurring as a result of the synthesis of protein that is taken from the nucleus into the plasmid reticulum. We have unfolded proteins which are essentially removed because either they've been folded or degraded by the unfolded protein response. And then we have another input of VIP. VIP is continuously being synthesized as well to keep the constant basal levels. And of course, if the ER stress and the unfolded protein response are activated, this folding, this rate of influx would increase into a very high concentration. And when we have the sensor that essentially can be bound with the VIP, that is a folding chaperone, and then the VIP can essentially dissociate it and can bound then with the folded protein, And then, of course, if it bounds with the unfolded protein, we know that BAP is the first step to cause the change of the unfolded protein into an intermediate that is going to fold. So, of course, then it would disappear into the folding pathway. Or we could have, for example, when the association actually occurs, so it can dissociate back again. The sensor can associate with the unfolded protein. This would be the stress state, because of course, if there is a high input of unfolded protein, you are going to find higher concentrations of the sensors, which are free but associated with unfolded protein. And of course, the unfolded protein again can find the BAP spontaneously before finding the sensor and fold. And well, we can translate this. So each one of these arrows would have a rate coefficient. The ones that are reversible, of course, would have rate coefficients which are reversible. We write down by the law of mass action. We assume that the inputs are linear inputs. So we're not doing any sophisticated feedbacks in here. And once we have done that, then we are able to actually prove that there is stability which exists, and we have figured out even the right concentrations of the chemical components to trigger the stability. And with our model, what actually has shown is that a subtle change in the influx of the unfolded protein response can have substantial changes both in the way the unfolded protein response is activated and in the way the concentration of the unfolded protein is accumulated in the endoplasmic reticulum. If here we start to increase the concentration, the influx of unfolded protein, and here we're using molecules per minute per cell, so in the moment we have increased into a rate that is close to 800, we're going to find out that you are in a stable region of this stable bifurcation diagram. The unstable region in here, unfortunately, is not marked here, so something happened when I transformed this from Linux to Windows. And you are going to jump then to a higher concentration of the unfolded protein. So if the influx is increasing, so the mechanism is keeping into a very low concentration of the unfolded protein unless you have reached a certain threshold where it's going to accumulate to a higher concentration, and then it would trigger the typical aggregation disease. Of course, if this occurs, the mechanism of stress would be triggered. So in here, I'm going to show you, so we have two states. Remember that the state in which we have the sensor associated to the VIP is in stress state, and it's marked here in blue. For lower influx of the unfolded protein, we have that this unstressed state is in a very high concentration. As we are increasing the influx, it would jump then to a lower concentration state, while the stress sensor, which is associated with unfolded protein, would increase its concentration substantially, and then it would jump to a higher concentration. That this would be the stress state. Of course, if I show this into a medical school, nobody has an idea of what I'm talking about. So they don't know anything about bifurcation diagrams. So the way we generally translate the bifurcation diagrams is in bars. So remember, they always have these nice gels where they observe high concentrations, and the gels then translate it into bars. And well, here we have the bar graphs, where we have the red is unfolded protein in a very low concentration. Once, if the flux is low, it can increase its concentration into a very high value. And then we have the state, which is the stress state, is in a very low concentration. And then the non-stress state is here in a very high concentration. Once we have crossed the threshold for triggering the unfolded protein response, the switch would be activated, and then the stress state would go very, very low. So this is something that actually our colleagues in the makers will can understand very easily. So this is the best way to explain bifurcation diagrams, and you put a line where, of course, this would only explain it in one direction, so you cannot explain them that the other direction would work slightly different. But anyway, so it helps to put the message across. And now, well, that we have actually proved that we have the sensing mechanism, now what we have to go is go back to experimental evidence of good applied mathematicians. So we have to boil down now to reality, and I have to figure out if our model is realistic and can explain the current experimental evidence. So the first experimental evidence comes from this paper in the Journal of Cellular Biology, in which they have essentially knocked down the binding site for the sensor and BAP. When you knock down that binding site, effectively what you are doing is that either the binding site doesn't exist, or you have make it of such a low affinity that then that reaction is going to occur with a very low probability. So the reaction in which they're going to be binding the VAP is almost very low. And what we have found out is that if we start to decrease, then the mathematically, so we could have the mechanism without that binding site, or we can asymptotically assume that, well, K is tending to zero, and then we can see what is the asymptotic response into our reaction mechanism. And what we have found out is that as the rate constant, so the catalytic rate constant that triggers the binding of the sensor with VIP, start to decrease, then the threshold for triggering the unfolded proton response, as a matter of fact, start to decrease as well. What's going to happen is that you will still trigger stress, but it's going to be triggered in a very low concentration. And that's something that, as a matter of fact, has been proved experimentally in here. So we have the concentration changes in the wild types where they are not being affected. And then when you're affecting into the wild types, you can observe that for lower states in the concentration, the response is actually triggering in places where it wasn't triggered before. So good for us. No? It's actually working. But one thing that you cannot predict with these gels of the protein concentrations is the following, which is a prediction that we have made with the mold, is that despite that VAP seems to be down-regulating the stress response, well, as a matter of fact, it's not only down-regulated, but as well it's changing the way the response actually works. So it can affect the qualitative behavior. For the existence of that site, for the binding, when the binding is effective and it has a high affinity, we have the typical stable behavior, where we have the stable steady states, and then the unstable one. As you start to decrease it, and you go asymptotically to zero, you're going to find out that you lose the stability. Instead of having a switch on and off that physiologically would make sense, essentially you have a response that will behave more like with a Michaelis-Menten type cure, so where the unstable state is going to be almost zero, and then suddenly you increase the concentration to a very high state. So very low influx in the unfolded protein would trigger a high response. You wouldn't have the switch-like behavior. So this is a prediction that we have made with the model that actually needs to be tested experimentally. So during the activation of the unfolded protein response, so an increase in the VIP concentration will switch the steady state of the sensor from the active to inactive form. That's a result which is very well known. So what they do is that they can actually make the cells to overexpress the folding chaperones, particularly the VIP. That is the first one that will remove immediately the unfolded protein from the endoplasmic reticulum. And well, if we increase the flux of VIP substantially, we're going to find out that the concentration of the active sensors is going to decrease substantially. And of course, I'm showing here the result that we showed to the biologist, which is a bar. And this is a prediction that we made, which is a prediction that, well, is assumed to be valid for most of the biologists. The higher the concentration of VAP, the better, because the stress would go to the lower concentration. And that's shown by the reverse effect, which probably is not the best proof, but when you are in a stress state, the only way that you move away from that stress state is increasing the VAP concentration to a very high value. And well, from the mathematical point of view, what actually is occurring is that the overexpression of VIP can lead to an activation of the unfolded proton response by essentially shifting the bifurcation diagram. And here, while we are increasing the influx of the VIP, so we have a first switch. Imagine that you start your sensor working in this region with a very low concentration of VIP. The stress, the unfolded proton response, what it's going to do is that it's going to increase once it's activated the synthesis of VAP into a very high concentration. In the moment you do that, so if you are in the stress state in here, so when you have a high VAP concentration, this is going to be your bifurcation cure that would activate a switch. If you were here, you're going to drop down there and you won't be stressed anymore. And it would happen systematically as you increase the VAP concentration. One prediction that our model makes that it hasn't been proved yet experimentally is that if you increase and you overexpress to a magnitude which is massive the VIP concentration, then the system would never enter into stress. Why? Because, well, you're going to always have stable steady states that are going to have a stress concentration which is not of the same threshold that you will have for the active sensor to be activated. So this is something that needs to be proved experimentally, and we haven't done that yet. So these are hot results, which are just coming out of the oven, so the bread is still warm. The most important parameter so far that we have been able to characterize, and this is just a bit of, as well as the computational mystery, and we have done a bit of sensitivity analysis, that we have systematically started to vary all the kinetic parameters and the concentrations to find out which is the one that can actually driven the multistability. And the only one that seems to be driven the stability is, in fact, the catalytic constant, which is, again, the constant for the association of the VIP and the sensor. If we change this constant, we can be in a region of the state where you have three steady states, and actually it's pretty big. As you start to decrease the affinity and you go lower, that region of B-stability decreases to a point where it's not going to be robust anymore, the response. Or if it's robust, it's going to be extremely sensitive to a very small domain of the parameter space. So from the evolutionary point of view, although we believe that this association only is attenuating the form in which the response actually occurs, we actually believe that this association is fundamental for the existence of the stable behavior. At the moment, all the other parameters that we have been varying systematically doesn't seem to be that important for the existence of the multistability. So this is so far what we have found. So we have, you know, tried as much as we can. This requires more than mathematical analysis, unfortunately, computational analysis, because we need to be running these exercises numerically multiple times, and we have been running this for nearly a year and a half, and no other parameters have proved to be as strong as this one. And well, in summary, I just want to tell you what we have found, and then I'm going to briefly talk about what is the future and many problems that I do actually believe that are very important for mathematicians to get involved on. So what we have found is that, well, the sensing system is capable of a switch-like behavior on and off states, and which are separated by biological improbable ones. The instability behavior, one of the beautiful things that it has, is that from the experimental point of view, only the stable state states are the ones that we can measure. The unstable state states, for their nature of small perturbations, can actually make you move away from the state states. They cannot exist on their physical conditions, or if they exist, they're very difficult to measure. And when we assume that every time you have a response, a stress response like this one, this has been the triggering that we observe experimentally, it has to be driven by a stable behavior that gives the switch on and off. Well, chaperones, which is the VIP in here, well, they're not essential component for triggering the sensing mechanism that important down regulators, and they not only down regulate the way the response is occurring, but as well, they down regulate the region of instability to a point where, well, if actually the chaperone, this binding doesn't occur effectively, then we're not going to have the sensing mechanism working with a stable switch. And well, a proper change in the influx of the chaperones can restore homeostasis. And well, this is expected and is predicted by the model, what is not predicted by experiments yet, so it hasn't been by experiments, is at a very high concentration, so a continuous overexpression of the chaperones actually would stop the sensor mechanism. And you know, this is important from the physiological point of view, because in some occasions you can have cells dying, that they are dying as a result of the triggering of the unfolded protein response, but you can actually have the patient by, for example, in the case of insulin, you can inject the insulin that the patient can live, but they still do require to have the beta cells for other very important functions. And well, we rather prefer to have the cells in the tissue than not having the cells at all. And we can actually stop the suicide of the cells by just stopping the stress response. It could be an extremely important factor from the medical point of view. Other people have selected not working on the stress response, but more on the downstream effects that actually will stop the apoptosis process by itself. Well, what we're doing in the future now, so I told you that this is an extremely nice area of research because nobody's doing Turing in it. Our lab at the moment with this specific problem is heading in the following thing. So we are trying to figure out if this sensing mechanism is robust. At the moment, the model we develop, so it's very naive. And I'm going to tell you why it's very naive. We have assumed that the model follows the law of mass action. The law of mass action on this part of the world that has probably made me very well known in the mathematical biology community is only valid on a very restricted set of conditions. And generally, the test tube type conditions, you have to assume that the reaction environment is homogeneous, you don't have reaction diffusion, and the concentrations of the chemical components which are interacting, they are very high. So the number of non-reacting collisions, as a matter of fact, has to be much higher than the reacting ones. And that generally occurs when you have very high concentrations of chemical components. As a matter of fact, that doesn't occur in the endoplasmic reticulum. The endoplasmic reticulum is the second most crowded organelle of the organism after the nucleus. There is a large number of jungle of molecules in there, and you have as well very specific geometries. Trying to model this with the geometries and the limited diffusion is our next step, and it's not a trivial step to actually achieve. Not only that, so as well, we have to do that. And in addition, we know the number of receptors that you have, so these sensors that activate the folded proton response. And in a cell, there are around 100. So when you're talking only about 100 of molecules in a large cell, so the process is inherently stochastically. So we need to actually figure out if this hybrid mechanism that we're proposing is robust enough for explaining under limited diffusion conditions where you have anomaly on reaction kinetics and stochasticity is still to be valid. And it's a major question that requires a substantial amount of work. The other thing that we haven't done so far is that I showed you in one of the previous slides that we were studying the process in the ER lumen, but then the influx of the unfolded protein and the VIP, as a matter of fact, they are triggered by what happens inside of a cell. So there are a series of pathways that would active would attenuate the incoming influx of unfolded protein, and there are pathways which essentially would increase the concentration of VIP. We haven't added those factors into a model. So now we're trying to build a model where we don't have only the response in the ER lumen, which is like the black box in the problem at the moment, but as well we want to incorporate what is known. And if we actually do that, maybe we can have a further understanding of how the mechanism actually works. And well, the other thing is that we want to do a set of pharmacological predictions and being paid by somebody who wants to find a cure for diabetes. And we actually believe that type 1 diabetes could be triggered by a problem in the folded protein response. There are two hypotheses of how that occurs. It's not worthwhile going through the details. But this is a problem that we're actually interested in dealing with. And that not only entails having the right mechanism, but as well studying what are the weakest link and the strongest link for treatments in the whole process. These are the exciting problems that we're involved on. There's another problem that I think is extremely important for mathematicians to get involved on. At the moment, I told you about this threshold mechanism where, in the case of Huntington, you can add the Q-tails and you can have one Q-tail, two Q-tails, then you reach 37, you don't have Huntington disease, you don't form aggregates of proteins. But something happens when you jump to 38 Q-tails, aggregation actually occurs. That's a common characteristic of all protein folding diseases, of conformational diseases, like Alzheimer, like the diabetes phenotype that I was describing, that you tend to have a very low concentration of aggregates and a subtle change in the concentration of the misfolded protein. So it's enough for triggering this, what they call it, the biologists they call it threshold phenomenon, for having no aggregates or very low level of aggregates to have a very high concentration of aggregates. And at the moment, there are 32 mechanisms of protein aggregation. 27 of them are well characterized for aggregation in vivo. The remainder are described for aggregation in vitro. So if you take those mechanisms and actually you model them, none of them can explain the threshold phenomenon. And we're trying to figure out why that's the case. Maybe the mechanisms are not appropriate for describing what actually is occurring. And that's one of the major questions and the major problems that people have on protein folding diseases or conformational diseases, because stopping this trigger that would create a high concentration of aggregates is the main problem that people have. And the pharmacological treatments, instead of being focusing on stopping the stress, should be focused, in fact, on the primary cause of the stress, which is the formation of the aggregates. And that's still a mystery, and we have a manuscript on the preparation, where we have found a common motif between all these aggregation mechanisms that could explain the triggering process, though we're still not entirely sure. And well, this is so far the problem, so I have gone superficially through the mathematics, where again, the equations, so if you look at them, they're ordinary differential equations, so the problem here became more from the numerical point of view of finding the visibility. But I explained you the procedure, and well, hopefully the main biological problem, and I have shown you an exciting area in biology, which I think is extremely important nowadays in medicine. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Thank you.